Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in for a deep dive into a career that is really defined by two extremes.
Cold pulls apart, yeah.
On the one hand, you have this astronomical professional achievement, and on the other, a spectacular, very, very public implosion.
Mm.
We're unpacking the life, the work, and really the paradox of Carlos Irwin Estevez, who we all know as Charlie Sheen.
It's pretty rare that we look at a figure where the source material is just so, you know, such a profound dichotomy. You've got the hard facts of Hollywood success. I mean, a Golden Globe, multiple Emmy nominations, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, all the way back in 1994.
A huge career.
But that whole story, that narrative, is constantly at war with this torrent of self-created chaos, substance abuse, controversy, and then that chaos somehow it morphs into this unexpected, totally quantifiable influence on global health. It's wild.
It is. And that's our mission for this deep dive. You want to follow that whole arc. We're going to trace his path from those, you know, early critically acclaimed dramatic roles all the way up to his peak as the highest paid actor on television. And then we have to analyze the infamous Tiger Blood era, his legal battles, and that surprising societal impact of his later disclosures.
And if we want to set the stage properly to really get the scale of his success and then the fall from it, we have to start at that financial peak.
That's great.
Here's the raw fact, the thing that just anchors his celebrity power. In 2010, Charlie Sheen was making $1.8 million.
Wow.
Every single episode of Two and a Half Men. That's the kind of money and influence that really defines a modern celebrity monarch.
It's an almost unimaginable number. And it just shows you how high he had climbed, which of course means the stakes were that much higher when it all started to unravel just a few months later.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's go back to the beginning. Carlos Irwin Estevez, born in 1965 in New York City, one of Hollywood's great acting dynasties.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
The Estevez lineage it's fundamental to his whole story. His father, Martin Sheen, was born Ramon Estevez. His older siblings, Emilio Ramon, his sister Renee, they're all actors. This was a family that was just steeped in the craft, you know?
They lived and breathed it.
But they also understood the power of, let's call it, a stage identity in American show business.
And the name change itself, that seems like a really calculated move toward that tradition.
Oh, it is. Ramon Estevez became Martin Sheen. Martin for a director, Robert Dale Martin and Sheen, was to honor the Catholic Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen.
Interesting.
So when Carlos follows in his footsteps, he takes Charlie, which is just the English version of his name, and keeps Sheen. It's an early sign that he gets it, that to succeed in that traditional Hollywood machine, changing your identity was often part of the deal, moving away from his clear Hispanic heritage.
He's sort of flexing those acting muscles really early, right?
Yeah.
Even in high school, Santa Monica High, making these Super 8 amateur films.
And look at his peer group there.
It's legendary.
He's working alongside Rob Lowe and Sean Penn, future stars. That environment, it must have been an incredible proving ground. It suggests that from, you know, a very young age, he was swimming with the highest caliber of talent, which probably just intensified his drive.
But then we see the first real sign of that duality, that split personality that would define his life.
The first deviation.
He gets expelled from Santa Monica High just before he was supposed to graduate.
Yeah, poor grades, bad attendance. And this is a really critical moment because instead of, you know, going back to get his credits or something, he just immediately decides to pursue acting full time. It shows this lack of tolerance for the normal rules and this complete conviction that he was ready for Hollywood no matter what.
And that conviction, it seemed to pay off pretty quickly. He had a tiny uncredited role in his dad's film, The Execution of Private Slovak, when he was nine.
Just nine, yeah.
But his first real credited film was the 1984 Cold War movie Red Dawn. And critics, they immediately picked up on the resemblance to his father.
And not just physical, but like thematically. That comparison was the defining thing of his early reviews. But it was framed as a positive. Like his performance in The Boys Next Door in 85 was constantly linked to his father Martin's work in those classic 70s films like Badlands.
So they weren't dismissing him as a Nepo baby.
Not at all. They were genuinely seeing an inherited talent for these complex, unsentimental performances.
But the year 1986 it's the absolute foundation of his fame. And it's where you see this intense versatility that almost no actor ever achieves in a single year.
1986 belongs to Platoon and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Two completely different films.
Let's start with Platoon. This was his huge breakthrough. The film becomes a cultural touchstone, wins 4 Oscars.
Yeah.
But the dedication for this project was extreme.
Right. Oliver Stone insisted on this brutal 30-day military-style boot camp in the Philippines.
It was designed to psychologically break them down, to simulate combat stress.
What were the conditions like? I mean, we hear it was just grueling.
They had strict rationing of food and water, barely any sleep, just relentless psychological pressure from military advisors. Sheen and the whole cast were just living in the jungle.
Wow.
It shows you this young actor was fully committed to the method to the point of, you know, severe deprivation. And his performance was called terrific, marvelous. He proved he could handle that dramatic weight.
And the irony is, in the exact same year, he pops up in a completely different mode. This brief but instantly iconic scene in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
And this is where the story gets fun. He's the juvenile delinquent at the police station. Mm-hmm. To get that authentic, disheveled, worn-out look, Sheen just stayed up all night before the shoot.
That's dedication for a tiny role.
It's a testament to his innate ability to deliver authenticity, even in a small comedic part. Critics said he made a great impact in this one brief scene. To have 2 top 10 grossing films in the same year, one a searing war drama and the other a teen comedy classic, I mean, that's phenomenal for a 21-year-old.
And that dedication continued. He reunited with Stone for Wall Street in 1987, starring as Bud Fox opposite Michael Douglas.
Yeah, he's basically the audience's way in, the greenhorn yuppie drawn into Gordon Gekko's world.
And the critical assessment of Wall Street is maybe the most revealing part of his early career. It shows this conflict the critics saw in him.
It does. The Washington Post loved him. They called him perfect as a greenhorn yuppie playing with the big guns. They saw his kind of earnest quality as fitting the role of the apprentice.
But not everyone was sold. Roger Ebert, in particular.
Yeah. Ebert was famously critical. He said Sheen's performance was the film's weakness. Ebert felt he wasn't relentless enough,
right,
that he lacked the intensity to convincingly move in those cutthroat circles. And this is a fascinating insight. Stone needed Bud Fox to be ambitious, but also morally compromised, but maybe Sheen's natural on-screen persona, which often had this vulnerability to it,
right,
held him back from portraying that truly ruthless drive the role needed. It's a little hint that maybe his dramatic range was a bit narrower than people first thought.
So as we move into the late 80s, his versatility just keeps expanding, and it's often driven by his real passions, especially baseball.
His love for baseball was almost a second career. He was an avid player, and this passion directly influenced his film choices. He took the role of Happy Felsch in 8 Men Out,
the 1988 film about the Black Sox scandal.
Right, a really acclaimed ensemble film. He took it solely for the experience of being in a baseball movie.
And that love was so intense, it even dictated the roles he didn't take.
Exactly. The story is that he passed on starring in Bull Durham,
a classic,
to take the role of Ricky Wild Thing Vaughn in Major League. And Major League turned out to be a stroke of genius, both for him and for his image.
Oh, absolutely. It solidified that image of Charlie Sheen as the cool, slightly rebellious guy with a ton of attitude.
And the critics were genuinely surprised by his comedy chops. Empire Magazine called him a delightful surprise at light comedy.
And that shift toward comedy, you know, using his natural charisma, that led directly into his huge commercial success in the early 90s.
The parody films.
Hot Shots.
Yeah.
And Hot Shots, Part 2. They were massive commercial hits that just proved his bankability.
But here's where we get back to that incredible duality.
Right.
The same actor who could get expelled from school and was known for his personal issues could also commit to this extreme level of discipline for a movie that was, let's be honest, basically a gag reel.
The commitment for Hot Shots, Part 2, is genuinely shocking when you think about what was going on in his personal life at the time.
To prepare for those satirical action scenes, Sheen did what he called an insane physical regimen. We are talking 8 hours a day, 6 days a week.
8 hours a day.
A strict diet, yoga, swimming, stationary biking, intense martial arts with a personal trainer.
That's the discipline of an Olympic athlete for a comedic sequel.
It speaks volumes about the compartmentalization in his life. The professional machine, when it had a clear goal, could operate with this almost terrifying precision.
Right. That discipline just wasn't translating into his personal life.
Not at all. But professionally, he was still willing to make these extreme sacrifices for the craft, even in comedy.
However, the mid-90s, that marked a financial peak. that pretty quickly turned into a creative and commercial dip. He started leaning into action roles and got his highest movie salary, a staggering $6 million for the 1994 action film Terminal Velocity.
And that $6 million salary is key. It shows his market value was based on his past success, his star power, not what he was currently doing.
Because Terminal Velocity was a certified box office flop.
Pulled in less than half its budget domestically. This period, with films like The Chase, you see his star power in the film world just start to dim. The audience was getting tired of the generic action hero thing.
And critics found his performance boringly flat.
Yeah, suggesting he was just phoning it in, relying on his persona, not on his performance.
But before we move into the 2000s and his TV dominance, there are two really humanizing, contradictory stories from the mid-90s. First, his first try at a sitcom was, well, he was paralyzed by fear.
Yes, his guest spot on Friends in 1996. Mm. This is the man who had become the king of the live studio audience sitcom. And he was so nervous performing in front of that crowd that they had to pause production. It's this remarkable flash of vulnerability. It suggests that the controlled environment of a film set was his comfort zone, and the immediacy of live TV, at least initially, terrified him.
And yet, right alongside that anxiety, he delivers a performance in a totally unexpected genre that gets a huge cult following.
He anchored the sci-fi cult film The Arrival in 96. He played the paranoid astronomer. And even though the film was a box office flop, it found a second life. His performance was praised as the role he was born to play. Critics said he carried the film admirably.
So even during his commercial slump, those flashes of real talent were still there.
Often in unexpected places. Yeah. And that era kind of ends perfectly with his self-parody cameo in Being John Malkovich in 99. He even got a Screen Actors Guild nomination for it. Hollywood still appreciated his unique identity.
Okay, so the 21st century opens, and Sheen finds the perfect vehicle.
Yeah.
The television sitcom. A medium where he could fully merge his established persona with, you know, commercial stability.
His pivot started in 2000 when he replaced Michael J. Fox on Spin City. And this wasn't just a placeholder move. The show's ratings actually went up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, especially in that really desirable 18 to 34 demographic. It proved he could draw an audience to serialized TV.
And that success translated pretty quickly into some serious industry recognition.
Absolutely. He won the Golden Globe for Best Actor for Spin City, and that just validated his move to television and set the stage for the true cultural phenomenon that was coming next.
That phenomenon, of course, was Two and a Half Men. He's cast as Charlie Harper in 2003, and the character was famously designed to capitalize on his well-publicized bad boy image.
The genius of Two and a Half Men was that they didn't try to hide his notoriety. They packaged and sold it. Charlie Harper, the hard-drinking, womanizing jingle writer, was basically the sanitized sitcom version of the public perception of Charlie Sheen.
And his performance made it work.
Crucially, a USA Today review pointed out that he was so amusingly sardonic and cheerfully self-aware that he made Charlie Harper's immaturity endearing rather than annoying.
He wasn't just earning praise. He was earning astronomical money.
The earnings progression was just astounding. 4 Emmy nominations, 2 Golden Globe nominations, and by the final season, that $1.8 million per episode salary made him the highest paid actor in television history at the time.
He was literally at the peak of his professional power.
Holding massive leverage over a primetime juggernaut.
And this is the moment where that professional control we saw during the Hot Shots era completely vanishes. Replaced by utter unmanaged chaos.
The slide began pretty quietly, January 2011. Production on Two and a Half Men had to be put on hold.
Right, because he was entering his third substance rehab attempt in just 12 months.
Which established this pattern of unreliability that the network just couldn't ignore, despite his salary.
And then the situation just escalated dramatically the next month. He started a very public, intensely aggressive feud with the series creator, Chuck Lorre.
He used highly offensive personal language. And that led CBS and Warner Bros. To just immediately terminate the rest of the season's production.
And Sheen's reaction wasn't, you know, regret or silence.
No, it was a demand for a 50% raise,
yeah.
Claiming he was underpaid.
Underpaid.
That hubris, combined with everything else, led to his contract being officially terminated in March 2011.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The meltdown that followed became arguably the most significant monetized celebrity spectacle of the early social media age. This wasn't a private crisis. It was a public performance.
A performance that completely bypassed traditional media. It was all live interviews and his own video posts. And he just unleashed this torrent of bizarre, self-aggrandizing rhetoric.
We all remember the key phrases.
Oh, yeah. Describing himself as a warlock with tiger blood and Adonis DNA, repeatedly claiming he was winning.
$1.8 million an episode, and he's convinced he's underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where do you draw the line between a celebrity owning their chaos and what just sounds like pure delusion?
That's the core question that made it all so captivating. It was a genuine crisis played out with the vocabulary of a superhero story. He truly believed he was functioning on this higher special plane.
A total bitchin' rock star from Mars.
Exactly. The videos smoking through his nose, ranting at his former employers. It was unprecedented. The sheer absurdity captivated millions. The media wasn't covering a crisis. They were covering a live, unscripted reality show.
And Sheen very quickly proved he was an expert at monetizing that infamy. The chaos wasn't just chaos. It was profitable.
Immediately. The scandal led to the highest-rated Comedy Central roast in their history. Drew 6.4 million viewers. The public appetite to witness this was just voracious.
So he decides to take the show on the road.
He launched the My Violent Torpedo of Truth Defeat is Not an Option tour.
And the demand was just shocking.
Tickets sold out in 18 minutes. A Ticketmaster record. He reportedly earned $7 million from the tour in 2011, plus another million from Twitter endorsements. This period is a textbook case of turning professional wreckage into immediate, massive personal revenue. It proves that in the digital age, attention, even negative attention, can be instantly monetized.
And despite the intense legal battle, the lawsuit against Lorianne and Warner Bros., which was settled in September 2011, he had this very unexpected moment of public maturity.
Yeah, at the Emmys that same month, he goes on stage and gives this surprisingly gracious statement to the cast of Two and a Half Men, wishing them all the best. It was such an abrupt shift from the rock star from Mars persona, a moment of unexpected professional reconciliation.
And he successfully leveraged it into a new show, Anger Management, which proved he was still, albeit chaotically, viable.
100 episodes. He was still a draw.
The public meltdown of 2011, it was really just the amplified culmination of decades of personal turmoil, centered on relationships and persistent substance abuse. We need to detail the history that fed into that chaos.
It's important to frame this not as, you know, isolated incidents, but as a recurring cycle of volatility. Sheen has been married 3 times, has 5 children, 2 grandchildren, but the relationships, they often ended amid these highly publicized legal disputes.
Let's go back to the beginning of the legal issues.
Yeah.
The 1990 incident with his then-fiancée, Kelly Preston.
Preston broke off their engagement after a gun discharged in their house. It injured her with shrapnel. Now, while Preston later said it was clearly an accident, the incident was serious enough to end their relationship very swiftly and very publicly.
The divorce from Denise Richards in 2005 brought some truly shocking allegations into the public domain.
Richards filed for divorce, citing drug and alcohol abuse, plus alleged threats of violence. But the court filings also had these highly disturbing accusations about his online activity, suggesting he looked at gay pornography featuring boys who looked underage and expressed an attraction to underage girls.
Which he denied.
He denied them vehemently, but he did admit that the FBI searched his computers. He said they were returned 2 weeks later. Regardless of the outcome of those specific claims, the public record shows a profound personal collapse in the mid-2000s.
And that turbulence just continued right into his third marriage to Brooke Mueller, which led to his 2009 arrest.
He was arrested in Aspen for assaulting Mueller. He eventually pleaded guilty to misdemeanor assault in 2010. And the plea bargain mandated 30 days in rehab, probation, and anger management, which clearly did not work, culminating in the 2011 peak of his meltdown.
And the final break with Mueller was right at the height of the Tiger Blood era.
Mm-hmm.
The situation got so volatile that police had to intervene and remove their children.
Mueller got a restraining order, and police removed their twin sons from his home. Her legal reasoning was just straightforward and damning. She said she was concerned Sheen was currently insane. That's the context for his personal life while he's performing for millions. And during that same manic period, he was living with 2 women, a porn actress and a model, who he called his goddesses.
Why the name goddesses? What did that term really reflect about his mindset?
It perfectly embodied that rock star from Mars persona. It was a self-aggrandizing term to place himself at the center of this hedonistic, superior universe. He was crafting a reality where he was the divine authority, a reality that was just utterly divorced from the legal and health crises unfolding around him.
And predictably, that arrangement didn't last.
Both goddesses left him by mid-2011.
We really need to detail the history of his substance abuse, which was the central driving force behind all this.
It's the engine of the chaos.
Let's trace it back to a crucial incident in 1998. This was a genuine life-threatening event.
In May of 98, he suffered a stroke after an overdose on cocaine. He later gave a frank interview in 2004, revealing that this particular overdose was caused by injecting cocaine.
Oh.
He was rushed to the hospital. Crucially, later, while trying to complete court-mandated rehab, he tried to leave the facility but was physically forced back by sheriff's deputies. That underscores that even professional intervention had to be enforced against his will.
And that cycle clearly persisted into the Two and a Half Men era, right up to the major 2010 incident at the Plaza Hotel in New York.
Right. Police were called after he caused about $7,000 in damage in his suite. And in the police report, Sheen admitted to drinking and using cocaine that night. This consistent pattern drug use, arrests, mandated rehab, property destruction is the direct cause of the network losing faith in him, which ultimately leads to the 2011 firing.
So after all the professional and personal wreckage, we get to the most unexpected paradoxical chapter of his life. His personal disclosure leading to a documented global health phenomenon.
In November 2015, Sheen publicly revealed he was HIV positive, a diagnosis he had received about 4 years prior. He described absorbing those three hard letters as one of the most difficult moments of his life.
And the lead up to that disclosure was financially and emotionally ruinous for him.
Yeah, he claimed to have paid about $10 million in total to extortionists since 2011 to keep his HIV status secret.
$10 million.
That financial burden, coupled with the need for secrecy, it undoubtedly amplified the chaos and instability he was going through. He was managing his condition with standard antiretroviral drugs, and he maintained he had been upfront about his status with every partner.
But his public stability was threatened when he briefly abandoned his proven medical treatment for something highly questionable.
In late 2015, yeah, he revealed he had temporarily gone off his medication to pursue unproven alternative treatments in Mexico. From someone claiming to have an HIV vaccine, this was a huge public health risk and a really concerning personal decision.
But he went back on them.
Fortunately, he quickly resumed the established antiretroviral treatment shortly after, realizing the danger of relying on unverified methods.
Meanwhile, the legal challenges continued, all stemming from his condition.
He faced lawsuits from former partners who claimed he had concealed his status before engaging in unprotected sex. One of those suits was settled for $120,000 in 2022. It's critical to note, however, that in his upcoming 2025 documentary, he maintains his consistent position that he has never transmitted HIV to another person.
Okay, let's dive into the core insight of this whole story, the Charlie Sheen effect. The irony here is just stunning. The chaos that fueled his public visibility ultimately resulted in a quantifiable, positive societal benefit.
Researchers studied the impact of his 2015 disclosure, and the data is genuinely remarkable. In the 3 weeks right after his announcement, there were 2.75 million more HIV-related Google searches than researchers would have statistically expected in the U.S.
2.75 million. But what were people searching for? Was it just gossip?
No, and this is the vital distinction. Researchers were able to categorize the searches. Crucially, 1.25 million of those searches were directly related to public health outcomes.
Like,
people were searching for condoms, HIV symptoms, HIV testing locations, and how to get tested. This was attention translated directly into education and practical health investigation.
And the commercial impact confirms that translation into action.
A later study tracked the sale of at-home HIV testing kits. Sheen's disclosure corresponded with a massive 95% increase in the sale of those over-the-counter kits.
95%.
This is a dramatic, measurable public health achievement driven entirely by a celebrity scandal. Commentators pointed out that Charlie Sheen, through one moment of personal disclosure, did more for HIV education than most UN events do.
This presents a profound ethical paradox. The worst period of his life, the period defined by legal abuse, drug overdose, public volatility, that's what created the platform for this massive beneficial health intervention. It's the ultimate chaotic positive externality.
It is the defining feature of his legacy. The professional accolades might fade, but the data supporting the Charlie Sheen effect is a permanent, documented record of a public awareness shift catalyzed by celebrity crisis.
Okay, now we shift to the current era, where Sheen is engaged in some self-reflection through a new memoir and a documentary, offering fresh perspectives on his past, his politics, and these unresolved controversies.
His opinions have always been highly visible, often contradictory, and sometimes, yeah, deeply controversial. In 2015, before the HIV disclosure, he was trying to define himself politically. He identified as a constitutional Republican and even floated the idea of running for president in 2016.
But Republican identity didn't last very long, especially when it came to his views on Donald Trump.
No. Only a year later, in 2016, Sheen was fiercely critical. He labeled Trump a charlatan and even controversially wished death upon him.
But his most recent comments from 2025, they suggest another major evolution in his political thinking, moving toward a self-defined middle ground.
In recent interviews, he stated that while he voted for Kamala Harris in 2024, he now claims he is actively listening to both sides. He even praised some of Trump's foreign policy efforts, specifically around negotiated international agreements. He said the current state of the Democratic Party had caused him to part ways with them.
So it reflects a willingness maybe to adopt a more nuanced, nonpartisan stance that a lot of celebrities avoid.
Right. And on social issues, his views are equally strong, even when they conflict. For instance, his stance on gun control after the Sandy Hook shooting was very emotional and direct.
Despite being a gun enthusiast himself,
he spoke passionately for stricter gun control. He issued a direct challenge to the NRA, urging them, if anybody from the NRA wants to look any of those parents in the eyes and tell them that guns are still necessary, I urge them to, and see how that goes.
It was a powerful human appeal.
But then you have his staunch advocacy for more fringe theories, specifically about 9/11 and vaccinations. His advocacy for the 9/11 truth movement goes back years. In 2009, he publicly appealed to President Obama for a new investigation. His position was that the 9/11 commission was a whitewash, suggesting the truth was being concealed.
And his anti-vaccination stance became a key flashpoint in his personal relationships.
It was a major source of conflict in his divorce from Denise Richards. Richards claimed that when she vaccinated their daughter, Sheen accused her of poisoning her, leading her to conclude the marriage was irretrievably broken. It shows how deeply held and how disruptive his views could be.
We must now address the serious, long-standing allegation made by the late actor Corey Haim concerning an incident in 1986 on the set of the film Lucas. This requires careful and impartial handling.
Absolutely. The allegation claims that Sheen raped Haim. It's an extremely complex situation because the accounts are contradictory and the alleged victim is deceased. Sheen sued the National Enquirer over the story, which was settled confidentially in 2018.
What are the key conflicting accounts that cloud the issue?
Crucially, Corey Haim's mother, Judy Haim, publicly denied that Sheen raped her son. She maintained that the claims were made up. But conversely, the claim was repeated by actor Corey Feldman in a 2020 documentary.
And Sheen's most recent public statements, made in 2025, have been forceful and absolute in their denial.
While promoting his autobiography, yes, he vehemently denied the allegations. He called them a bullshit, a vile work of fiction, and a hideous insult to Haim's memory. He directly condemned Feldman for amplifying the claim.
And in his documentary, he explained why he didn't sue Feldman.
Right. He said his motivation was strategic. He didn't want to provide Feldman with more content or further platform the claims, which suggests an attempt to exercise professional control over a narrative he insists is false.
Perhaps the most surprising professional development of the last few years is his unexpected return to collaboration with his former adversary, Chuck Lorre.
This is a remarkable demonstration of professional healing in Hollywood. The series creator who famously fired Sheen from his highest paying job, Chuck Lorre, cast Sheen in his Max series, Bookie,
which ran from 2023 to 2024.
This reunion suggests that time, sobriety, and mutual professional respect ultimately transcended that volatile feud of 2011.
We also saw a brief symbolic shift in his professional identity during this later career phase.
For the 2013 film Machete Kills, he chose to be credited under his birth name, Carlos Estevez, for the first time. The move, which was his idea, was specifically due to the film's Hispanic theme. It's a late career acknowledgement of his heritage, even if it was a one-time thing.
Finally, his upcoming 2025 autobiography, The Book of Sheen, and the documentary, aka Charlie Sheen, have brought forward some deeply personal late-in-life revelations about his sexuality.
He revealed that he has had sexual encounters with several men, and his manner of disclosure was defined by the startling candor. He asserted, "I'm no longer running from anything." He took full responsibility, dismissing any potential judgment with the defiant, "so what" attitude.
A huge contrast to the years of guarded secrecy that defined his earlier persona.
Exactly. A very late stage willingness to publicly define his full identity.
And to wrap up the personal life developments, we have to touch on the recent family situation involving his daughter, Sammy Esteves, starting an OnlyFans account in 2022.
This was a clear point of conflict. Sheen initially expressed public disapproval, saying the decision did not occur under my roof.
Right.
However, he later softened his stance. He eventually offered public support for his adult daughter, citing arguments made by Sammy's mother, Denise Richards, who advocated for Sammy's right to pursue her choice. It shows a personal shift towards supporting the autonomy of his adult children, even when their choices are controversial.
What an exhaustive journey through the life of Charlie Sheen. We've gone through the extremes. From acclaimed Oscar-adjacent performances in Platoon and Wall Street to achieving that unprecedented salary peak as the undisputed king of TV contracts.
Then documenting the self-destructive chaos of the Tiger Blood era, the legal turmoil, the immense financial burden of extortion, and his surprising return to professional respectability with Chuck Lorre.
The career accolades, the Golden Globes, the cult status of his baseball films, they are profoundly significant to his status as an actor.
However, what is truly unique about his story is the mechanism by which fame operated in his case. The very public crisis that led to his professional ruin and personal exposure that ultimately created the necessary noise and attention to drive the Charlie Sheen effect.
Right.
The raw, unedited chaos of his life was the catalyst for a fundamental, positive, and measurable shift in global health awareness about HIV testing.
It really forces you to reconsider the ultimate purpose and utility of celebrity in the 21st century.
Indeed. We leave you with this provocative thought, the central paradox of this entire deep dive. Considering the overwhelming power of celebrity attention in the modern world, does the profound, unexpected, positive societal impact of the Charlie Sheen effect, the millions of public health searches, the massive jump in testing kits, does that fundamentally outweigh the personal and professional destruction of the period that caused it? What does it say about the true nature of fame that an actor's greatest documented humanitarian impact stemmed not from dedicated activism, but from his most chaotic, self-destructive public moment? We encourage you to explore that question further.